American Paper.
Welcome to episode 120 of Paper Talk, a series of podcast interviews featuring artists and professionals who are working in the fields of hand papermaking and paper art. I'm Helen Hebert, and I run Helen Hebert Studio, a hand papermaking studio in Colorado's Rocky Mountains, where I create artist books and installations. I also host the annual Red Cliff Paper Retreat and papermaking masterclasses here in the studio, and I run a membership program called The Paper Year and teach online classes about paper, light, and books, too. Find out more at HelenHebertStudio.com. You can also find the show notes for this episode at HelenHebertStudio.com/podcast. Today, I'm talking with Melanie Mowinski, who likes paper but loves what goes on paper. Paper becomes a vessel on which she prints, collages, draws, constructs, and more. Mowinski draws inspiration from the landscape of her Berkshire Hills home and residencies and travels to places like Iceland, Morocco, Tasmania, Venice, and most recently from along the Camino de Santiago in Spain. She began her daily creative practice over 20 years ago as a Peace Corps volunteer. What began as a way to document the toughest job she would ever love evolved into one of the most important parts of her artistic practice. This practice formed the foundation of her book, Collage Your Life, published by Story Publishing in 2022. Her letterpress prints and artist books are in numerous collections, including the Tate Modern, Oberlin College, and the Clark Institute. She's taught workshops at Wells Book Arts Center, Williams College, and other art centers around the world. She holds a master's degree from Yale University and the University of the Arts. Mowinski is a professor of art at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts, MCLA, in North Adams, Massachusetts, and is the founder and director of PRESS, Letterpress as a Public Art Project. Enjoy our conversation. Well, Melanie Mowinski, welcome to Paper Talk.
Oh, thank you so much, Helen. It's so nice to be here. Thank you for inviting me and sending me great questions. I can't wait to talk with you.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it too. Okay, so let's dive right in and tell me a little bit about where you grew up and what kind of artistic, creative life you had as a child.
I will. Awesome. Yes, I will. Okay. So I grew up in Ohio because anybody who's anybody really comes from Ohio. You can really check a lot of history books. There's a lot of cool people who are from Ohio. I grew up in a town sort of midway between Akron and Cleveland, Ohio. I went to college in Cleveland, Ohio. I went to the Cleveland Institute of Art and Case Western Reserve University. But I don't even remember. I've always wanted to be an artist. It was this thing that I don't totally know exactly when the moment happened. I have a memory of sitting on our window seat and drawing and deciding I'm going to be an artist. And my parents were really great about it. In some ways, I think I have this, when I'm being very generous, sometimes I get mad at my parents, like we all do. But For the most part, my parents were really supportive. They enrolled me in different kinds of after school art classes. And then when I got to high school, it was clear I was not deviating from this path of being an artist. So they enrolled me into
how do you think you knew that being an artist was a career path?
I didn't care.
But you must have seen artists I don't know. Well, you think it was your own?
Yeah, because I did not grow up going to art museums. Okay. We did not. That was not something we did. That was not part of our practice. And I don't know. I really don't know. I just knew that I like to do things with my hands and make things.
Yeah.
And I was going to do this. And I didn't care how, I think part of it was this I started to draw and then I started to sew and make things. Mm-hmm. And so I think it was really more that way that I really, really like sewing. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to be a fashion designer when I was in in high school. And so I
Okay.
sewed a lot. I made a lot of my clothes, and I was really and truly on that path. And I think that's that at some point though, during that, when I got to high school, I had a really great art teacher, and my parents putting me at things in classes at Kent State and the Cleveland Institute of Art. And I think it was through then that I'm like, I don't want the life of a fashion designer. That it became somehow I knew that that was the pace and the kind of party drug culture that often is it's often infused with some of that, or at least in the 80s was. I didn't want that. And so, but I still wanted to be an artist. So I think it was that was what it was like that. And this is where things start to get tricky with my parents, where they didn't think going to art school was a good idea. Then the only way that I could go to art school was if I became an art teacher. And so it was like, I had this idea of being a fashion designer, and then it was like, I don't care, I'm gonna be an artist. And then my parents are like, no, you're not. You have to be an art teacher. And that was the compromise that was made. So when I went to college, I went to college for I haven't my undergrad is I have a Bachelor of Science in Art Education, and it was a degree that I got there was a wonderful program between Case Western Reserve and the Cleveland Institute of Art. So I did all my STU art classes at the Cleveland Institute of Art, and then I did my education classes at Case Western. So it was a great degree. And then, I needed to do this, my dad would call this do good work. So I was a Jesuit volunteer and then a Peace Corps volunteer. And it was through those experiences that I just started to see, at least like I started to form some of the conceptual background of some of my work, of wanting to find ways to connect art, the environment, and some kind of a spiritual practice. And I didn't know what that meant. And not too many people were really looking at that or thinking about that in the 90s in a way that there is today. And I don't even know what, the influences were. I was a church kid. My family was very Catholic. And there were things about that that, I don't, I'm not sure how that influenced things, except sort of this thing that was this current running through my life.
I totally understand that because I was a church kid too, and I was raised in the Episcopal Church, and I definitely have that kind of yearning to give back, and so cool.
There's, I can't separate it.
So what was the period of time, the Jesuit volunteering and the Peace Corps? How many years?
So that was like, well, there was a little bit of a break between the two of them, but that was about a 4 to 5 year time period. I would say about a 5 year time period, because I had a job in between the Jesuit Volunteer Corps and the Peace Corps. And it was really during that break, that I was living in San Francisco and had this great job in Pacific Heights. I was living in Bernal Heights, and it was my like I was on my own. I was in California. It was really cool. And I started taking these community ed classes. So I took a class in collage. And I don't think I'd taken any collage classes in college, like any collage, those kinds of things. And I took a class in papermaking. And I've been trying to figure out who that person was who taught me papermaking. It was up in in San Francisco, there's those towers, that big TV tower thing. It was over there somewhere. And I would go, I had to take two buses to get there. I would get home really late, and I learned how to make paper, and it was great. And so then, like, she was really great in she taught us how to make our own mold and decals, and she taught us how to make paper from recycled paper. And so right before I went to the Peace Corps, I got myself a blender. Actually, I think I've upgraded that I would make recycled paper with. So I would, get all the junk mail from our house, and this is before I knew anything about archivalness or acid or anything, like, making paper in in the garage, my parents' home, with this blender, blending things up, making these pieces of paper. And I didn't know. I just liked the process. I just loved having my hands in that slurry and just feeling it all. And then I went into the and then I went into the Peace Corps. And I don't I can't remember if I made paper there. I'm sure I did. I'm sure I made it. I had a friend there who was like a ceramicist. I think we traded different activities. But again, you know, making the paper from what I could find using a blender, really DIY.
Yeah. And where were you in the Peace Corps?
I was in the Caribbean.
Okay.
Let me say that kind of like. But and not only was I in the Caribbean, I was an art teacher. So there aren't any art teacher positions right now in the Peace Corps, but back in the early 90s, mid 90s, you could go to Botswana, Ghana, or St. Kitts. That's where I went and be an art teacher. And I originally was supposed to go to Botswana, but I had accepted this job in San Francisco. So I postponed it. And then this position in St. Kitts opened. So I was there for 3 years.
Oh, wow. And were you teaching in a high school, young kids? What
I was teaching high school and
high school.
I was there. I was brought in with there were a few of us. I think there was one art teacher in each of the main high schools. So there was four high schools.
Mm-hmm.
And we were tasked with working with the Ministry of Education to create an art curriculum so that students could take the Caribbean exam, the CXC, the Caribbean Examination Council, which is similar to the British system where they have these different forms. And once you decide on focusing on a couple different classes, you take an exam. And our plan was, our job was to develop this curriculum. And the thing that's really great about it is that it's still happening, like that the art program is still there. A lot of times you hear about Peace Corps programs that when the volunteer leaves, the program leaves.
Right.
And that did not happen with my program, which was really great.
Yeah. Wow. That is great.
Yeah.
Yeah. We need that here in America, right? Cool.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So then what happened next?
So after that, I went to grad school for the first time. I was, again, trying to figure out how to connect art and religion and the environment. And I applied to a lot of different places, and I ended up at Yale University at the Divinity School. Because I could take classes at the School of Art, the grad school, the Divinity School, and the forestry school. And I really created, nobody knew what to do with me, which is often the case. And they gave me a lot of flexibility. So I took a lot of different classes and really sort of looking at this, I think I sort of centered on this thing that that Paul Tillich would talk about in this, he's a German philosopher,
mm-hmm.
of this sort of creative spark, like where does that impulse is really that connection to the divine, to the universe, to that great sort of being. And that was really what I was looking for, is like, where does creative practice start? How does that formulate in us? How is that connected to something outside of ourselves? So, and then the, you know, sort of the sub thing was looking at the role of God and art in nature, and not in, like, a lot of times when I say, so my degree from Yale is a master's of art in religion and the visual arts. And when people hear that, they automatically assume the Renaissance and biblical paintings,
mm-hmm.
all of that. That was so far from what I'm interested in. It's really, you know, closer would be someone like Mark Rothko or James Turrell, Sister Carita Kent, although I didn't know about her work at that point. But I think James Turrell and Mark Rothko really are good examples of these, of how do you use, at least contemporary examples. But then there's also other things related to that, just in, like, you, me, everybody we know, like, where does that creative impulse come from? And sort of looking at that thing that Paul Tillich would talk about.
Yeah. Wow. That's really cool. So was this a degree that was unique to you, or how?
So the degree, the Master's of Art in Religion and the Visual Arts,
that
is
was
there.
A
like that
degree.
is a solid degree. And I know a number of people now, like coincidentally, there's somebody who's here at where I teach now who had the same degree, like and from a very different time period and a very different focus. But it's a flexible degree, and it's kind of a cool way to discover and learn what you want to learn.
Yeah. And I don't know if I've mentioned to you before that my mother went to YDS, Yale Divinity School.
You did. Wow. Was she ordained? Is she ordained? And what was her degree?
I don't know that. I don't know if there was a specific degree. Let's see. Master's in Divinity. That's
I'm
what she,
dead. Cool.
Okay, and you have we're going to talk more about your daily practice, but I know you started one when you were in the Peace Corps, so let's just touch on that.
So I when I went into the Peace Corps, I wanted to, I mean, it's a big deal going into the Peace Corps. At least I think it's still a big deal. It certainly felt like a big deal when I did it, and I wanted to be able to document it in a way that would be memorable. And so I created this calendar, and I decided to do it while I was there. Just sort of this idea came to me. I had a horizontal calendar, so the calendar was January, all in one page calendar. One of my friends had it where it was January and then just a line and then February, so all the months sort of stacked on top of each other in horizontal rows. And I liked that idea, and I'm like, oh, I'll figure that out. And so I bought the only piece of paper that felt sturdy enough that I could find on this tiny, 49 square miles. And the thing is St. Kitts 49 square miles is the same size as San Francisco proper. So it was like, here I am on this tiny little island. I just was in San Francisco, and now I'm living on this tiny island that has nothing, but with only like 40,000 people, like this, whatever. So I found this piece of paper, and I ruled it up the same way. And then each day I would make a little drawing, have different symbols and things that I use. And so that was in 1995 I started it. And so next year is, I think actually it will be the 30th year that I do it. Or is it the 29th? I'm very bad with math.
That's really cool. And so, how much time do you spend on it?
It depends. If I'm good, good, whatever that means, and I do it every day, it takes me like 2 or 3 minutes a day, maybe. If I'm bad, whatever that means, like I get behind, and then it can take longer because I have to look at my calendars, I have to look at my date book, I have to scour my memory. And so I try to, it goes, comes and goes in waves. Sometimes I'm right on track, sometimes I'm not, just really. But
And you have these on your website, right?
I do.
Yeah, so we'll put a link to these because they're quite striking to look at and they've changed over time and
They have.
So you indicated you had a first master's degree. So what did you do after that?
So after my first master's degree, I got a job in the Berkshires where I live now, at this tiny little groovy progressive high school called Buxton School. And I should say one thing. While I was at Yale, I took this class with this woman named Constance Pierce, and she introduced me to book arts. We went to to Sterling Library, which, if you've never been to New Haven, if you ever have it, if you go, you should do yourself a favor and go to Sterling. It's just a magnificent building. And so she had them pull artist books, and it blew my mind. I had no idea. And so while I was at Yale, I took a continuing ed class in book art somewhere because they weren't teaching it anywhere at Yale. And I started to get a sense of what it meant to make books. And so, and then I also met Paulus. Oh, no. This is a pivotal thing, actually, this story I'm going to tell you. So there's this artist named Paulus Berenson. He
Yeah, I
wrote this
met him.
book, the book Finding One's Way with Clay. And so when I was in college, my degrees in college were fiber arts and ceramic, where my focus was fiber arts and ceramics. And so Paulus Berenson's book was huge for me. So at Yale, I had this one professor who introduced me to this program
in England at this place called Schumacher College. And I went to this, went to a class with that was taught by Thomas More and Joan Hanley. So Thomas More wrote a book called Care for the Soul. And so the first night at, and this is, and it was all about looking at this whole art and ecology and God together. Mm-hmm. And this, I, this is actually really pivotal, maybe one of the most important moments of my life, this class, just meeting people, older people, my elders, people who have been around the block many times, who this is their life. And so it was this, I saw these people working with these ideas. And the first night there, I go into this, there's a little like cafe bar, and I go out there, and there are these two beautiful older men, and I start talking with them. And this one guy is like, yeah, I'm a potter. And I'm like, huh? And I couldn't remember the name of this book, or I couldn't remember Finding One's Way with Clay, and I couldn't remember Paulus's name. Couldn't remember any of it. I'm like, do you know this book? And I described the book to this man. Mm-hmm. And he's like, I do know this book. And he's like, I wrote it. And I'm like, what? You wrote it? He's like, I wrote it. I'm Paulus Berenson. Like, I mean, it just like blew my mind. And then I met this guy named Peter Adams, which was, as Paulus would say, was one of his fairy godchildren. And Peter has this wonderful place in Tasmania called Wingrove. And that moment and what it led to is really what it's why I do a lot of the work that I do today. Because so in between my these two master degrees, I was teaching at Buxton. I'm learning about book arts. I meet Paulus and Peter. Peter invites me to come to Tasmania. I go to Tasmania. I start experimenting with paper and doing things with paper. I start making books. And I really am like, okay, I need to figure this out. I need to go deeper into this book art thing. And so I go to the University of the Arts for their book arts and letterpress program. And, you know, I'm having this correspondence with Peter, and Peter's work is, he sort of also introduced me to this idea of dailiness and daily practice. I go back to his, go back to Tasmania. I went to Tasmania in 2003. And then I go in 2005, in between my first year and my second year of my MFA program. And Peter's in the middle of this it's more than 333 days. I can't remember how many days it was, but he was going into the ocean every single day it was an extraordinary number. It was years. I can't remember what the number was. And he went every single day, regardless of the weather. And he had this peace fire that he was tending. And so he kept the fire lit this entire time, and he would go into water every single day. And the place Wingrove is this place that he bought and rehabilitated by planting trees and doing all kinds of different things to it. Cultivating it, moving the land, being steward, exactly, steward of the earth. And so I'm there with him, and there's nobody else around, and I'm there for 4 weeks, and I'm trying to figure out what to do. And so I start making these tree rubbings, and I'm wrapping, they're huge, you know, some of them are like 3 feet by 5 feet. I got this roll of paper. I'm using the charcoal from this peace fire. And then I'm wrapping my body, I'm wrapping the paper around the trees, making these rubbings, and really thinking about how a tree is like a human being. Some of them are gnarled, some of them are really beautiful, some of them are really like damaged and hurt, and just like looking at that mm-hmm. the details and the nuances and the essence of the tree, and how that you are the tree, I am the tree. And so that whole thing, like if I hadn't gone to Yale, I wouldn't have had that professor who introduced me to this place in England where I met Peter and Paulus. And then I went to Tasmania, and Paulus really has this wonderful journaling practice. So he taught me how to Coptic stitch. And I went to Penland to see him and learned how to Coptic stitch. And that was like this whole thing. Like, it, you know, it's like these different little seeds.
Yeah,
that like, you know, I wouldn't change any of it, because if I hadn't gone to Yale, I never would have met Peter, and I never would have made these tree rubbings, which are really critical to a lot of the things that I made later in life.
It's yeah, and I know, and it's like interesting to look back now, right, and see how all the things dovetail and piece together. Do you know the work of John Wolseley? Did you meet him in Tasmania?
Oh my God, John Wolseley is like my hero, my hero. So I wrote him a letter once. He wrote back, and he like, I'm sorry, I'm like blowing your ears out with my.
No.
Yes. Oh my God. I am such a fan of John Wolseley's work. He's like, he is up there, totally up there.
Because I think it was 2009, maybe, there was an International Association of Papermakers meeting in Tasmania. And I went, and John gave a talk, and he also gave a workshop. And so, listeners, if you don't know him, look him up. The one thing I remember, he would take paper and bury it or hang it on a tree or whatever and just leave it out in the elements for months, years, I don't know how long, and then go back and get it and then draw into it in tandem with nature. So he took the watermarks and the scratches and wrinkles and all the things as to influence his drawings. Yeah.
So I did this. What the first time I went to Tasmania was in 2003. I did this. I took these papers, and I think they're on my website, the images of them. If not, I'll send you images of them.
Okay. Yeah.
I wrapped this really beautiful watercolor paper onto eucalyptus trees on Peter's property, and he sent them to me a year later. And I've never done anything with them. They are too beautiful, and then precious. It's like, what do I do with them? But I'm sure that John Wolseley, seeing his work at that time, I'm sure that's a lot of the reasons why I started doing the tree rubbings, because I do the same thing like with them. I go back into them. It's very different from his work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I have a couple of his books. I pull them out pretty regularly to remind myself of his work, and I like fan art, you know, like not doing the work like he does, but he's definitely his.
Oh, so cool. And I met Paulus Berenson at Penland, and yeah, interesting. We have a lot of overlap. Hey, listeners, let's take a little break here. And I want to tell you about The Paper Year, my annual subscription club. It's kind of like a year-long online class and features a new paper project every month. Get inspired with video and written project instructions designed to spark ideas that keep you creating for the rest of the month. Explore creative paper techniques, including origami, pop-ups, paper weaving, book arts, paper cutting, and more. And join our growing community of paper lovers online to learn and share in a warm, encouraging, supportive, creative community. Visit HelenHebertStudio.com to find out more. Registration will open again April 1st, but you can hold your spot now. Now back to our conversation. What did you focus on at University of the Arts?
So it was really this tree rubbing and paper. But you know what? I think like I have done a lot of projects, right?
Yeah.
And so the other thing that I was doing while I was at the University of Arts, where I inaugurated this paper word project, and it was all connected to trees. And so I had to take paper making classes while I was at UArts. I had to really learn how to make paper versus the DIY thing that I had always been doing. And so I did. I took a number of, I think I took paper making classes every single semester. And then it was actually, oh, it wasn't my first. Was it my first? No, it was in my second year. I don't remember. One of the years.
Who taught paper making?
Rattlin. Lynn Scherz. So I studied with both of them. And I don't even know how I came up with this idea, but I just started making these paper words. And so paper words, I use abaca fiber, and I cut out letters, or no, I cut out words on the anti-fatigue matting. And I would sandwich it between really large molds and decals. And then I would pull a piece of paper, put it onto the felt, and then I would put different pieces of string on top of it. And then I would pull a second page and put it on right on top of it, and then sandwich them, blot them together so that they bonded. And so the paper is embedded in between them. And then I would take those paper words and I would tie them around trees.
The string is embedded between the paper. Yeah.
Yeah, the string is embedded between the paper, and that so that it holds the words together, and it also is embedded into holds the letters together, and then it's embedded in there. And when I first started, I chose the words care, love, respect, give, and hope. No, not hope. Care, love, respect, give. Forget what the last word was. And I made 25 of each of them. I made 100 of them.
Okay.
And I, this is before I knew anything about anything. If I was going to do this project again, I would, and Peter was coaching me from Tasmania, and he's like, you have to write press releases. You have to alert the press. You have to tell people you're doing this. Mm-hmm. And I didn't do any of that. I should have, but I didn't do any of it. And I just, what we would call now is I guess paper bombed Written Square Park in Philadelphia on Earth Day. And so very early in the morning, some of my friends and my classmates came with me. We wrapped all 100 of these words around different trees throughout Rittenhouse Square, and they were up for the whole day. And then at the end of the day, I took them down. Never, you know, really. And I think that thing of, like, I like the idea of stealth things, like doing things without anybody knowing it's me, and then like taking it back. And since then I have, I don't know, probably 24 different installations of these paper words. So I did this before I went to Tasmania, because I took them. So somehow this tree thing was starting before I went to Tasmania, because I took them with me to Tasmania and tied them around those trees. And then I started tying them in different places. And what one of the places that really struck me was I did them here at the Clark Art Institute, and they didn't even last 24 hours. Somebody took them down. I think Clark probably took them down. Uh-huh. And so sometimes I've asked permission, sometimes I haven't. I have collaborated with a poet to create phrases with the paper words. I've gone on to making other paper words. I've done the word breathe is one of my favorite ones. Stillness or be still is another phrase I really like. And so what I like is putting them into the woods and having people encounter them unexpectedly. They're really, really wonderful.
And do you observe that? Like, how do you know about these encounters? Like you mentioned, the Clark took them down. What are some other encounters?
So some of it is, as I installed them at the Norman Rockwell Museum, and I had worked with one of the curators there to do it, but he didn't tell anybody that he was working with me. Mm-hmm. And so they discovered them, and someone was like, who is this paper terrorist? And I'm like, or tree terrorist, taking these paper words and wrapping them around trees, which I kind of liked. And I also didn't like that phrasing. Uh-huh. And some of it is just watching, like just being in the woods, like shortly after it, I've done them, and just watching someone pause and have a moment with it, and then just moving on. But often times when I've seen that, the person walks in a slightly different way. Like it's almost like they're paying attention in a different way, because it's unexpected, this thing.
Right. Cool. Yeah. Wow. Okay. So then after that second degree, I know you're a professor now at MCLA. Right. How quickly did that happen?
I got a job, you know, after grad school. I applied for what felt like a bazillion jobs, and I wasn't getting anything. And I got a job in the back here in the Berkshires at the Berkshire Museum. And while I was there, I was invited to start teaching at a drawing class here as an adjunct. And then a full-time position opened, and I applied for it and I got it. So it was 3 years in between graduating from the University of the Arts and getting this job. And so I've been here now 15 years, which is crazy to think about.
And let's just say where here is Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts. Sorry, yeah. I didn't specify that. Yeah.
College of Liberal Arts, or MCLA. It's in North Adams, and you might know North Adams because it's the same town where MassMoCA, the Massachusetts Museum of Contemporary Art, is located. It's also just down the street from the Clark Art Institute, Williams College. It's really wonderful, right at the base of Mount Greylock, the tallest mountain in Massachusetts. It's a beautiful spot. I'm very lucky.
Yeah, so we must have met when you were pretty new there.
Yeah.
I just want to tell this story. Melanie, yeah, probably 2011. Melanie, I had just produced my piece, Mother Tree. And I don't know how you heard about it, but I remember, I can see myself opening your letter in my kitchen.
Was it a paper letter? Was it an actual letter?
You sent me a letter. Maybe you sent me some roots for it. I don't remember that.
So this letter.
I received a letter. Maybe you sent me some roots because I was asking people to crochet a strand. I don't remember. But you said, you know, you'd love to exhibit it or something. And you were, you know, a professor at this college. And so I responded because I wanted Mother Tree to go further than Portland, where I was living, Portland, Oregon. And we started this dialogue, and the publisher of my how-to book, Story Publishing, is in North Adams. So I thought maybe they would somehow get involved. And yeah, so it worked out that Mother Tree came to North Adams. Yeah.
You know, I think it was this whole thing of trees and paper and mothers. And I'm sure that that's,
The tree connection. Yeah, cool. So you do do you teach full time? Because you do a lot of other things.
I teach full time. And so, you know, I'm teaching full time. And when you teach full time, I mean, there's lots of things, but sometimes you hear about things that or people come to you because whatever mm-hmm. reasons.
Yeah. So
in around that same time that of Mother Tree, I get this email from someone that there are these three guys who own a Vandercook Universal 3, and they're looking for a home for it because where it lives right now, where it was living, it couldn't live there anymore. And the caveat was that they would give whoever this machine as long as they could use it once or twice a year. But you had to be able to move the machine. It was on the second floor of a building, mm-hmm. and you had to be able to take care of it. So I'm like, I have this money from being a recently hired professor. They gave us some money to help us get established. Wow. And I'm like, okay, well, I asked my institution if they would house this press. And I think they thought it was like a little tabletop press. And they said, yes. I'm like, great. So I used this money to move the machine, lived in, but it wasn't ready. The place where they were going to do it wasn't quite ready. And then they realized how big the machine was. It weighs a ton. It weighs like 2,700 pounds or something. And so it lived in my garage for a little while. And then one of my friends was like, we were doing this icebreaker about if you had a storefront, what would you do with the storefront? I'm like, well, I would move my Vandercook there and do something with it. I don't know. Mm-hmm. And he's like, well, why don't you apply for this grant? There's this grant for this space for like, you would only have to pay a couple $100 a month. And then you could apply for this other grant. And then this other grant, why don't you just do it? And two of those grants were due in like in 3 days. So I wrote the grants. I got every single grant I applied for in the beginning. I got every single one of them. So I felt like when the Vandercook was given to me, that I had a responsibility, mm-hmm. that I couldn't just keep it in my garage. I couldn't just keep it in the school. I had to share it somehow because it's too big of a gift to at least that's how I felt. So on this kind of whim, I open up this space that called Press Letter Press as a public art project. It was supposed to be a temporary summer long thing, and it ended up running for over 5 years. And to this day, people are like, "Oh, you never should have closed." And it was always the plan. The plan was always that once the space was available at MCLA, the machine would move there, and it would still be part of my teaching, but not in a public way. And it's still part of my teaching, but it's not in the way that it had originally been. So
talk a little bit about that public
So the project was, so we had a public, it was a studio, gallery, teaching space. And so in, so we would have different paper and print exhibitions. We had 6 to 8 different exhibitions every single year for those 5 years. That I taught pop-up workshops, I taught longer-term workshops. It was my classroom for some of that time period because the building where it now lives was being renovated. And it was my studio. And it was, I mean, it was really fun. I had a lot of, I would have, I think I had over 30 different student interns over the course of the project. And they did everything from learning how to print to learning how to do the social media to planning, writing press releases, installation. How do you create an opening? What are the food really, ordering and figuring out food for an opening, the cleanup. And one of the things that was really critical during this thing is we would make a card that we would give away at each of the openings. So every single, so each time multiply 6 times, let's just say 7, no, 5 times 7, because we had 7 exhibits a year, 5 years. We made 35 different cards that we gave away. And so they would be multi-layered letterpress cards that had some kind of inspiring statement. So, for example, I have one on my wall that uses a quote from Audre Lorde, and it says, "Begin, our visions begin with desires." And so it would be something like that, you know, something inspirational that you might want to put on your bulletin board. And it would be, it would have at least 2, 3, sometimes 4 different layers. And the thing, the gimmick was, is that you would come on opening night and you would press the green button, which is the, on a Universal 3, it's fully automatic. So you press the green button, the carriage goes out, it comes back, you get your print. It was magic, you know, magic of printing, the magic of letterpress. You saw it in person. You got this thing that you got to take away with you. People loved it. They loved coming in to watch us, like to see this technology and making that connection of where printing came from, you know? It was just, it was a really that experiential hands-on way of being in a space. I mean, it was wonderful. It was really wonderful.
Yeah. And it's wonderful to see how animated you are talking about it. Like you're just reliving it. It's wonderful.
First cards we made was never underestimate the power of enthusiasm. And it still is like, it was one of the best periods of my life. Like the camaraderie and the community with my students. I mean, it was really special.
Yeah. Now you did another project during this time, 1 card a week, right? So tell me a little about that.
Yeah, the 50 card project. So the 50 card project evolved out of this. So I loved making those cards. I still love making those mantra cards. I make them all the time at this point. But I decided I decided to make a card the day that Trump was inaugurated. And it was using FDR's words from his freedom speech, freedom of, I'm not going to remember what it is. Religion, freedom of, I'm sorry, I can't remember, it doesn't matter. Okay. And so I made that card. And then by the next day, I'm like, I'm going to do this every single week for the rest of this year. I'm going to make a card that looks at what's going on in our country and to try to find some, using words, some kind of positive phrasing out of it. Mm-hmm. And so every single week I did a Kickstarter for it. And the edition size was 100. Most cards had anywhere between 2 and 5 colors. So you can imagine making a 2 to 5 color. I mean, cause there were some that only had 1 color, but, and those were the weeks that were pretty busy where I'm like, I got to get it out. I got to do this. And so I would print on Fridays, and then I would send them to people who supported the Kickstarter project. I also sent them to Trump, everybody in his cabinet, sent them to my senators. I never got any response from anybody from in politics. I'm sure they got lots. They get, somebody out there maybe has a collection of these cards that were sent to some aide, maybe. I don't know.
How did you send them? You didn't send them every week.
I send them every week.
You did, to all of the subscribers. Yeah. So were they sent as postcards?
They were postcards. Yeah.
Okay. And so that's a whole other
That's
production.
Awful. Yeah. Yeah. Right.
That's why you had interns, probably.
Yeah. No, actually, yes, I did have an intern then. I did. That's
Okay.
right. I mean,
Yeah.
and it was critical.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And no response. That's too bad. But yeah, as you say, maybe they made an impression, I'm sure. Okay. And so how did you get into collage? And I want to talk a little bit about paper. And I know you organize your papers and you have a book about collage. Yeah.
Book about collage. You know, it's so funny, this whole book about collage, like, because I wouldn't call myself a collage artist by any stretch. I make collages, but I'm not a collage artist. I work with paper is how I talk about myself as an artist. And I think what happened was in 2011 or 12, I was just right around this time of the year, I wanted to do something different in order to think about Advent and the holiday season. And it needed to be something that was flexible and small and could go. I was traveling a lot. I'm always traveling. And so I put together some paper and that could fit into a quart size Ziploc bag. And so size was, I think, was 5 by 5 inches would be the base of the form. And I could fit the glue stick, my bone folder and whatever paper and a little pair of scissors in there, and I could go anywhere with it. And you'd be surprised how many little collages you can make with a handful of papers. So I decided to do this every day as a way to just sort of center myself during the winter holiday season. I had gotten, and I still am sort of fed up with how consumer oriented it is.
Yeah.
And wanting to find different ways of centering myself and being in the moment. And so I started doing this. And then as part of it, I was writing these little pep talks on my blog back when people would read blogs. And I kept doing it. I did it in 2011 and 12, kept going. And then I taught a class where one of the students really enjoyed it, and she asked me to create prompts to go with the daily reflection, and so then I started adding the prompts, and then it occurred to me maybe there's a book here, and the book I had envisioned and the book that came out are slightly different, but I wanted to make a book that really kind of captured all of those sort of pep talks, because my book Collage Your Life, there's a section of it that is kind of how to, but the 55 prompts and inspirations are really 55 creative pep talks, and then prompts for making either a collage or really anything. It could be a drawing, it could be a painting. It just gives you sort of some ideas to start something. But for me, the book is really about that creative, those writings, that creative pep talk. And it was something I was doing mostly, you know, I was doing it for myself. I would read something, respond to it, or just as a way to help myself get through this winter time period of the holiday season.
Right, right. And so the book, again, is Collage Your Life, and it was published by Storybooks, same publisher as mine.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's a great book that's out there in the world.
Yeah,
and are you, it's Advent right now, the first day, I think.
Yes.
Or maybe Sunday is. Sunday is the first.
Sunday. I think this past Sunday was the first Sunday of Advent. Today is like when the Advent calendars begin.
Are you doing a practice?
I am doing a practice this year, and I've been debating with myself what it's going to be for a while. And I have this book that I made a while ago that I am going to, I'm really fascinated by books of hours. And so this book that I'm using the sort of medieval, the Van der Graaf canon of page layout. I'm using that page layout, and I've used it before in my work. And then I'm making collages that inside that layout, and also ones that break that layout in a book form.
And is that, I'm not familiar with that. Is that like a designer? The layout?
It's like from like, I don't know. I'll send you some more information about him. It's like somewhere in the Renaissance. I don't totally remember. Jan Tiscold and some other early 20th century designers used a lot of his initial sort of it's like the medieval time period of how do you divide a page?
Yeah,
have that sort of layout. Mm-hmm. So it's a layout that would have been used for a lot of books of hours, medieval books, and I love that constraint and then breaking that. Mm-hmm. So I'm using that as the outline within this book, and then I'm building collages into it. And it's small. It's, you know, it's the book itself, I think, is 6 by 6 inches. It's a little bit bigger than the original, but my little package of supplies is a little bit bigger than I might want it to be, but it's still small enough that I feel okay putting it in a bag when I'm traveling.
Cool. I look forward to seeing that unfold. What kind of papers are you collaging with?
So with this is, I'm using mostly found papers from magazines, scraps from projects, and mostly some paste papers that I've made.
Mm-hmm. And I think you have an organizational system. So just talk a little bit about how you collect paper.
So I collect paper in a variety of ways, and it's shifting as I start to think about consumerism more and my own impact and what I'm putting into the world. I try to shop my paper collection. I used to buy a lot of paper from Pearl in New York City when they had the paper room. I buy paper from Talis online because I'm you know close to New York, so things are easy there. I will buy paper whenever, like if I'm traveling, I will go places. So I think it was Flax in San Francisco. I often go there when I was in California. I bought paper in Thailand. I bought paper in France and Italy, Morocco. Like wherever I go, I'm gonna look for the paper store and try to buy something. I have a couple of flat files where I have, you know, like the paste paper drawer. I have the handmade paper drawer. I have the machine made with certain thickness drawer. I have the binder's board drawer. So like I try to organize by type of paper that way. And then I have smaller organizational things. I have one of those plastic file boxes where I organize a lot of my collage papers. And then I will organize like this current project, the current little book for Advent that I'm working on. It's mostly pinks and blues and turquoise. And so I have a little baggie for that. And then I have another little bag or a folder, like those collapsible folders sometimes I'll use for specific projects. So I'll go through my bigger paper files and gather things and put them into those different smaller ones so that I have them at my hand. I have a small studio space, so I need to be very organized.
And the bigger paper file, are those organized by color or by type or image?
By type. Mostly by type, and then not so much by color because I tend to work in the same color palette. So so it's within it, I try to group them together, but that often gets mixed up.
So I'm sorry to be nerdy about this, but what do you mean by type? I don't even know what I meant when I used that word.
Okay, so what I like mean
thickness or yeah.
Yeah, that, I mean there's lots of different ways. So like vellum and anything that's sort of smooth, like not clear vellum, like vellum surface, Bristol board kinds of papers. And then there's like within the vellum Bristol board, there's also this one hot press watercolor papers and some printmaking papers. Those are all in one drawer. Okay. And then binder's board is in its own drawer. blotting papers and and then those like acetate or silicone release papers, those are in mm-hmm. their own drawer. Paste papers in its own drawer. And with paste paper, I try to organize it with kind of cardstock weight thickness and then paper text weight thickness. Mm-hmm. My drawer that's probably the most disorganized is the one that is sort of handmade papers, because I really should get another flat file to organize that, but I just don't have the space for it. So yeah. That is kind of a mix of things. I'm sure there's other kinds of ways that I do it, but those are the ones that come right to mind.
Cool. I love to hear that. Okay. So you had a couple of recommendations. Let's go to those.
Yeah, I think so since we're talking paper, I think one thing that I'm really, and this is also sort of something I'm working on right now recommendation. The artist Wangechi Muti uses this paper clay technique. And I saw an exhibit of hers this past summer. I think it was at the New Museum in New York City. And when you see these sculptures that she makes, they look like they're terracotta clay, but you then read that they're actually paper clay. And so she does this whole thing of mixing, I think it's even like wood glue or Elmer's glue with the paper, and it kind of stews. And then you put dirt and other colorants, natural material colorants, to kind of connect to the land. And then she makes it into these sculptures. So mm-hmm. I'm really curious about this. And I am going to be teaching my students how to do this next semester, and which means I have to learn how to do it myself.
Right.
But Wangechi Mutu's work is really striking and challenging and beautiful and wonderful. I highly recommend taking a look at all of that she does.
Yeah, we'll put a link in the show notes to her website.
And then I think the other thing is I'm also a very big fan of Marina Abramović. She's currently the first woman to have a solo exhibition at the Royal Academy in London. Mm-hmm. That exhibit will be closed by the time this podcast airs, and I will have not seen it. I'm very sad, but it's okay. But the reason why I like her, I mean, there's many reasons why I like her work, but this idea of challenging the self and the body, and she said this thing recently about understanding, if you understand the body, you understand the world. And what she often does is pushes herself through her body to experience things in the world. And she came up with these things, I don't know if she did, but maybe her people did, but it's the Marina Abramović method instruction cards. And so there are 30 different cards that you can draw one and do something. So one of them is on your hands and knees, wash the floor for 2 hours. And what comes out of that experience.
Wow.
Another one is immerse yourself into cold water and hold yourself in that water for 3 minutes. And what comes right. out of that. Mm. And there's 30 of these different kinds of things. But the whole thing of the card thing of, like, you know, pulling a card, whether it's an oracle card, whether it's a card you make your own deck, these things that get us outside of our regular practice and inspire us to do something else, that is, and who knows where it might lead to. So those are two things that are really in my mind right now.
Yeah, great. And well, you mentioned you're going to be learning how to make paper clay. Is there anything else you were coming up that you're working on?
Yeah, so I'm working on this project I've been doing for this past year related to water, and largely connected to Marina Abramović. I went into water for from the summer solstice to the fall equinox, and I'm still going in occasionally into water. It's hard to go into water in New England at this time of year. But I've gone in a few times already. I will continue. And it's a big project about water and fountains. I was in Morocco earlier this year and looking at the fountains and
Are you writing about it or
I'm writing drawing I'm, or, yeah. I'm doing a writing project, and then I have all these rubbings I've done of fountain ceramic tiles, and I've done this long book and these drawings, and I'm looking for a way to bring it together. I'm sure it's going to be something like John Woolsey, like where I take these rubbings that I've made, I work back into them with drawings, and then eventually it's going to be some kind of artist book. I don't imagine that this project is going to see the light of humanity for another year. There might be little tidbits, but there's a lot that I need to be that I'm in the thick of it.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah.
And it will come. Yeah. I love that. I want to end with a little story to you and get your response, because you use the word centering, and it took me right to this. I think it was after my senior year of high school. I did this program. I grew up in Texas, in the town with Texas A&M. I did this program called Career Horizons, and it was for students from around Texas who wanted to go into architecture. And I remember this whole thing, like I had to ask my grandmother for money to do it. Texas A&M is a very conservative place, but there was this one professor that was part of the program. And I think he was the most dressed up of anyone. Like, he wore a tie every day, but his tie was always like, it was wooden or just really unique. He must have had this whole collection of ties that were just, and I can't remember his name, but he named his kid Bunker Hill. I mean, like, he went to my church too, so I knew him. He was one of those occasional attendees of church. So he stuck out in my mind. And he had us do this centering practice at as part of this program. And I don't even remember that much about it, just lying on the floor. And he probably had some kind of prompt that he said, and we would just go into ourselves. And so I just wondered what the word, I can't even remember when you used it when we were talking, but if you have any association to that word.
The word centering.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, the first thought is thinking about, why is her name going out of my head? The potter whose book on centering that Paulus was friends with her. What is her name? Yeah. That is like my first thought is
so centering the pot. Yeah.
Yeah, that whole, thinking about that, finding.
Well, and that's so much more. MC Richards.
MC Richards. Yeah. So centering that whole thing of that piece of, like, in that centering process of when you're throwing a pot on the wheel, there's this thing of like, you're kind of going in, mm-hmm. like you have to go in. And so, like, you have to go in, and you have to, and then you have to pull out. And that, for me, centering is, I'm doing it. Well, you've asked me, so it's like I'm having and it happens when I set type. It happens when I when I'm working for types of artwork where there's this it's trying to take over me right now. So I'm having a hard time, where I become, I go in, and it's kind of like where peace and flow for me come together, where I'm in this moment of oneness. It's going to sound so woo, but like this moment of oneness with myself and whatever it is I'm doing, whether it's just sitting or whether it's setting type, whether it's pulling, you know, making
paper. Yeah. No, I totally get it.
That is a lot of it is in that action of repetition that,
yes,
but I can also at this point get to that place just by when I sit too. It's a calming sort of going in to go out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, thanks for going there with me. It reminded me, I took this pottery class at Texas A&M too, when I was in high school, and we made like a different, like a plate 1 week, a bowl 1 week, a cup 1 week. And I always felt like it was way too fast. I just needed the whole 6 weeks to learn how to center. Right. So
yes.
Yeah. Well, Melanie, yeah. It's been a real pleasure having you on the show. Thank you so much.
And, you're welcome. Thank you.
Look forward to seeing more of your work.
Hey, paper friends. Did you know that I write a weekly blog called The Sunday Paper, featuring stories of people doing exciting, innovative, and beautiful things with paper? Sign up at helenhebertstudio.com/blog. I'm also creating a lot of content over here, and the best way to stay up to date is to join my newsletter list to learn about free tutorials, online classes, workshops, and the annual Redcliffe Paper Retreat, which takes place right here at Helen Hebert Studio. You can find out more at helenhebertstudio.com. This wraps up our episode, and if you enjoyed the show, I'd appreciate it if you could leave a review over on iTunes. This helps others find out about the podcast. Special thanks to Gary A. Hansen for the sound editing and Peter Thomas for the music. Visit helenhebertstudio.com and click on podcast, where you can find out more about these guys, subscribe to this series via iTunes, and listen to other episodes and access all of the archived shows. Talk to you soon.
There's a reason besides the season, the making paper.